Thank you. Good morning, good day to each and every one of you. Thank you for the introduction, Frank, and thank you. I think it was Mark who introduced me to Tush Nua, A New Beginning, and Alcoholics Anonymous. What a great way for me to start the day. I was in another meeting earlier, actually. Let me get to the meat of it. I said I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ralph. I live in Los Angeles, California, in the northern part of the county, San Fernando Valley. I came to AA in August of 1999 by way of the court system. I was actually sentenced to AA. Part of the order was beside a few weeks in jail and a loss of community service and some drug and alcohol face-to-face and group meetings. I also had to do 18 months of Alcoholics Anonymous with the signature every week that I had to turn over to a probation officer. So that's what brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had decided to get sober before that, a few weeks before that, because alcohol really kicked me very, very badly. I think the last 10 to 15 years of my drinking were truly involuntary. In other words, I did not want to drink, but I drank anyway because I had to in order to function. I came to California in June of 1971. That's my last arrival date to this country. I was actually born in North Africa, in Tunisia, in a small oasis in the southwestern part of the country, to a fairly large family. I had two brothers and five sisters. So there were eight of us in the family altogether. There was really no alcohol in the family at all. The only alcohol we had available was rubbing alcohol. And many alcoholics say, you know, that would do actually when necessary. But that really was not a part of my story. I did not grow up drinking, but I did have a difficult teenage life during puberty. The age of 13, 14, 15, I was very rebellious and angry and so on and so forth. And they would say these days, probably the word, I guess, is non-compliant, did not adhere to the norms of society. I discovered Karl Marx at the age of 15, and I turned to a Marxist as a young man, rebellious and so on. Began drinking at the age of 18. And it did give me some calm, but it did not have that effect that people talk about of feeling like I have discovered nirvana, have found a home. But I remained that way. I went to France in 1969 to study, to college, and began to drink there quite heavily, actually. It was cold. I was a foreigner in a foreign land, and I was a student. I worked whatever I could do to make a living, emptying cargo planes and working in construction and sweeping metro subway stations and so on. And I drank quite a bit. I thought I drank because it was very cold. What I should have done is buy some additional socks or some more clothing to keep me warm. Instead, I thought the drinking hit a spot and made me feel warm. It also made me feel acceptable and made me accept my situation. I came to the States in 1970, first time, and then I came back in June of 71 permanently. And I began to work in this country, and I succeeded. I was a workaholic. In addition to being an alcoholic, I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I thought it was something people did. But then it turned on me. I began to collect driving under the influence of alcohol, citations, tickets. And I began to visit arrests and police stations. But I was working, so I was making some money. I had a friend who was a lawyer, criminal defense attorney, a wonderful guy of Ukrainian descent. Marinovich was his last name, Adrian Marinovich. He passed away a few years ago of a brain tumor. He was a fantastic lawyer. He managed to extricate me out of my problems, out of my predicaments. And he probably represented me 10 or 15 times in cases. And he always managed to dwindle them down from driving under the influence. He got them down to unsafe lane change, stuff of that nature, you know, unsafe speed stuff. But alcohol was always involved in them. But so 1978 was the first time I got the DUI. And I kept on going. I began to try to stop when my son was born in 1983. And I remember I could not stop. I wanted to because his birth was life-altering experience, but I just couldn't stop drinking. After work, I would go out with the guys and the gals and just consume an enormous amount of beer. Then I'll have a problem. So next time, after a few weeks of not drinking, I'll go back to saying, maybe I drank too fast. I should slow down. And I switched from wine to beer to organic drinks, all kinds of crap. Nothing worked. I always ended up in the same place. I remember not long ago, actually a few years ago, I was going through my personal belongings, trying to see why I had this life insurance policy. I had from New York Life. And I remembered vividly, my son was born in May of 83, and it was sometime during July of 83, I had given up on stopping drinking. I was convinced I could not do it and that there was no way of doing it. I was convinced that I was going to die as a result of my drinking. And so I went ahead and decided that as a responsible parent, as a responsible father and husband, I will go ahead and buy a life insurance policy to protect my wife and my son, to pay off the mortgage when I die, and leave a stipend for my wife to take care of my son. That I thought at that time was the rational thing to do, the logical action of a responsible father, husband. I didn't think I could stop drinking, so that I'll do this. Essentially, what I have done really is abdicate my responsibility, my conjugal obligations, my responsibility to my wife and to my son. I went ahead and paid a third party to take care of my obligations of taking care of them. Nevertheless, not forgetting the fact that I was missing in action, missing at home, missing the father-son bonding, missing the husband-wife bonding that is necessary for the development of a good family life and so on. And I was feeling extremely guilty for what I was doing, for what was happening to me as a result of my own action. And to deal with that guilt and with that state of chronic cognitive dissonance is what some psychologists would call it, I was drinking to cope. To cope with my discomfort and my dis-ease in those situations. And I'll relay a couple of events that I'll never forget. One of them was in the mid-80s, the French were sending some very freshly brewed Beaujolais, and they called it Beaujolais Nouveau. And there were signs in the city where I worked, in Beverly Hills, actually, there were signs all over the streets announcing the Beaujolais Nouveau and how restaurants are giving some very good deals on Beaujolais Nouveau, like a 50% discount. So I remember one time I went in with a couple of clients and an associate, and we sat in this fancy restaurant. We went early, as I always did, to get ready for the meeting. So we hit the bar first. And then when the clients came, we went ahead and sat at the table, and we had a nice dinner. I remember I had ordered the special of the day, which was a filet of sole cooked on some rice pilaf with a bunch of capers on top of it and lots of butter and stuff. And I drank probably two bottles of Beaujolais Nouveau. And when I came to after that dinner, I was in the jail of the Beverly Hills Police Department without my shoes and without the tie or anything, and they don't want you to hang yourself there. But when I came to, I saw the blue coats, the uniforms of the cops, and I realized I was in jail. It wasn't the first time, unfortunately, but the surroundings shocked me. I don't remember how I got there or what happened at that dinner, but I began to reconstruct what happened that night to see if I hit somebody, if I had an accident or whatever. And all I could remember is the fact that I did order filet of fish and that I was drinking lots of Beaujolais. And it hit me that the mistake I made was that I had red wine with fish, which is absolutely a no-no. So I blamed the friggin' fish. I said, if I had had some white wine, it wouldn't have happened. You know, this is the extent of the insanity of the life of that this alcoholic while I was drinking, and also the total irrational thinking, illogical, non sequitur. But it made sense to me at that time as a rationalization for why I got stuck. So I said, next time, I certainly will not have but white wine with my fish if I were to order fish. That was one event that I remember it very well. It bugged the heck out of me. Another time I remember, and this, I was reminded of this after I got sober, that we were at a bar in not about a block from the office with some other friends, and we were going to go to dinner to a restaurant, which was about three blocks away. And the guy said, well, let's drive and meet there so that afterwards we can drive away from the restaurant. And let's walk, they said, so we can have a nice walk and freshen up before we get to the restaurant and maybe build up an appetite. And my answer at that time, my friend Jerry told me, said, Ralph, you told us that you were too drunk to walk, that you'd rather drive. And I did that. I said, I'm too drunk to walk. I'm going to drive there. And I drove. And then I'm shocked when I get arrested for drunk driving, which is really unbelievable. Anyway, August 3rd of 1999 is the event that really changed my life. And I'm going to tell you what happened to me. You know, again, it was really a day like any other day. Just I decide not to drink. I'm at the office. I say I'm going to order Chinese or Mexican and eat at the office in the cafeteria. I didn't. I went out and walked a block to go to the bar. And so I keep calling it a bar. It's really a very nice restaurant. It does have a bar, but I always thought of it as a bar when actually it's a restaurant, and I'm sure the owner and the chef would be very offended if they thought that. But I went to the bar and I had my usual liquid lunch. I think it was probably Grand Marnier. I'd hit two or three big gulps of Grand Marnier, and it gave me a buzz, especially on an empty stomach. It gave me a little buzz. But in reality, it was not much of a buzz because I was actually in a buzz even when I didn't drink for two or three days. I was, my blood alcohol level was high and my brain was foggy, and it remained foggy for years, unfortunately. I was getting to that stage of alcoholism, and I was still managing. I was going to work. I was having problems getting tickets and stuff and forgetting and making mistakes at work, but I was having some serious problems, especially at home. Eventually, I went there. I had a few drinks. Then at night, we went out with my friend Jerry, another guy. We were going to meet three ladies in our real estate business. And whatever the heck happened that night, I don't remember what happened in the restaurant. I blacked out, but I left the restaurant, got into my car, and I had a brand new Lexus, one of those mini SUVs, 300 or something. And somehow I got into it and was driving, heading toward the freeway. And I got into a really nasty accident. It was a solo accident. I hit the entrance of a construction site on this main major artery, Wilshire Boulevard in Westwood near UCLA. And the car was crashed completely. And when I came to, I was across the street on the south side of the boulevard, looking at my car burning. It was up in flames. And there were some fire engines there. So a fire truck showed up. And they were dosing it with foam and so on. And I was sitting there just shaking my head. First of all, to this day, and this is 21 years ago, I don't remember where my car was, how I got to it. I still don't remember that completely. I was a total blackout. But I was shaking my head because here I am one more time in the same predicament I had found myself in many, many times before. And I felt that the feeling of Sisyphus, from the myth of Sisyphus, you know, pushing that rock up the hill and then seeing it fall down just as he was approaching the top. I was just in that same state of desperation that here I am again in the same position. I was bleeding. My chest was it was a wreck. And I was shaking my head watching my car burn. A police officer came on a motorcycle, gave me a field sobriety test, And I asked me if I had drunk. I told him, yeah, I did. And I flunked the field sobriety test, of course, royally. He handcuffed me and pushed me down to sit on the curb where I was before. And I was still sitting there shaking my head. A patrol car came, and a man and a woman, I don't remember who was driving, the man or the woman, but both cops picked me up and threw me in the back seat of the patrol car and slammed the door shut. And they were driving, and I could hear them yak-yakking about if I had gotten on the freeway, I could have killed a family of four. It's a good thing that this was an accident, that I was arrested before I could have caused mayhem and so on. And they were absolutely right, of course. But I'll tell you, as I was listening to them, all I could remember is the feel of the wind coming through the open windows of the front seats. And the wind was hitting the back of my earlobes. And I was overcome suddenly with an incredible sensation of lightness and of freedom and of hope. Somehow I felt like things are gonna be okay. I felt like things are gonna be different in the future, and that this is the last time I will be in this predicament. They ain't gonna happen again, I'm done. And I was not involved in any kind of intellectual exercise of thinking of causes and consequences in the future and so on. I really wasn't. I was truly overcome at the level of feelings only. And I personally believe that that sensation of that freedom and that hope was the result of my unconditional surrender. The unconditional surrender to the fact that I could no longer live the way I had been living for the last 50 years of my life. That something drastic has changed already in spite of me, in spite of my own thinking capabilities or intellect. I believe personally that that was survival instinct. That is pre-reflective. It precedes the functions of the frontal cortex of the brain. And it is actually probably more at the level of the limbic system, of the primordial or early parts of the brain, maybe the hippocampus, maybe the gland that's hiding in there, the amygdala, that is the flight or fight source of all kinds of things, that decisions that we make without thinking, you know, like ducking when a rock is coming my way without measuring its distance or its speed or its velocity. I think it was the survival instinct that stems from the reaction of cells at a very molecular, basic level, cells of my brain, cells of my bladder, my liver, my kidneys, that were literally screaming for life and opting for life, making a choice for life, because I was committing suicide a glass at a time on the installment plan, as they say sometimes. I was actually killing myself and killing various organs of my body as a result of my drinking. And I think those organs, those cells, those life source were screaming for life and demanding that they be given a chance to live, because I was killing them. And they were screaming, "You son of a bitch, stop it. You son of a dog, stop it. You're killing us. You can't do that." And I think that sensation that was overwhelming certainly gave me that sense that things are gonna be different. And I got the feeling of lightness and of nirvana. I get that feeling nowadays during meditation every once in a while, when I'm actually put in a state of homeostasis where I'm just focusing on breathing, on some very elementary function of breathing in and breathing out and thinking about nothing else except the sensation of being and not thinking, but being as a human being. And that's my explanation for that total surrender. And the desire to drink left me at that moment. I have not wanted to drink from that day to this day, as a result of having had that sensation of unconditional surrender that was in spite of my egoic mind that would get involved in rationalization, justification, explanation, and cause and effect, and so on. But that's also cause and effect. It's just pre-reflective. It precedes the thought process. So my opinion. My friends who are believers, because I'm an atheist or an agnostic, I'm actually an atheist. My friends who are believers tell me that what actually happened to me in the backseat of that car is the grace of God has reached in that patrol car on Wilshire Boulevard and touched me. And I insist that it's really the name that we give that condition or that state or that phenomenon is really irrelevant. It's just a symbol, just a word. The truth of the matter is it did happen. It's a feeling that has overcome me. And as a result of it, I've lost the desire to drink. And there's a lady called, called Dr. Montgomery. She has been in AA for 62 years. She always says that with unconditional surrender, there goes the desire to drink. It disappears when there are no strings attached to that surrender. And I'm one of the lucky ones who has experienced that. And I've heard it shared from the podium many a time by women and by men who have undergone similar experiences about giving up alcohol or drugs or gambling or whatever it is that has afflicted them. I ended up in jail that night, of course, and the next morning I called home, give you a free call, and it was about maybe 6:30 in the morning when I came to and realized where I was. And calling home, my daughter picked up the phone instead, and she was in 1999, Laila was 14 years old, and she said, she said, "Mom," she was yelling at her mother in the other bedroom, says, "Mom, pick up the phone, it's Dad, he's in jail again." So my son picked up the phone, and these are the morale boosters for a father. And my son said, "Is it true, Dad? Are you in jail again?" And I was. I said, "Yes, I was. Give the phone to your mom, please." So my wife, the poor soul, you know, and we had been married 25 years at that time. And we've just celebrated 47 years of marriage. She stuck with me all this time. She's an absolute angel. And I've had plenty of chances to make amends to her and to my son and to my daughter. And I continue to do that really because I have stuck with the program. But I'll tell you, I was sentenced in court. I had Adrian Marinovic represent me again. And he says, "Oh, Ralph, Jesus Christ, not again." So anyway, I got bailed out on my own recognizance. And my wife brought me a change of clothes and my car was totaled. So I ended up having to get a new car. And since I lost my driving privilege, and I insisted on the word privilege, I thought it was a God-given right to have to drive as a privilege, actually a license. I lost it for 2 years. So I ended up, because of connections, I got me an international driver's license, and I was able to use it to hide. But if I was arrested, I would end up in jail. I was sentenced to 3 years of jail, but was suspended with a five-year probation period. But I got 30 days locked up in the county jail. That was the minimum. And I was lucky that I didn't spend 30 days, only that one night when I turned myself in and was sentenced. And I was lucky the booking officers in the Twin Towers, in the county jail of downtown Los Angeles, had a sergeant who used to be one of my employees, a really nice Filipino guy. And he said, "Ralph, what are you doing here?" And here I was, you know, in my shorts, holding my shoes and my clothes. I told him, "Oh, just visiting." You know, I told him that I'm sentenced to 30 days. So he told me, "Would you rather do work furlough?" I said, "Yes." So I ended up doing a work furlough program for an awful long time, actually. I also had to do 280 hours of community service. Anyway, the sentence was severe. But to top it all, I had to do 18 months of AA. And it was all concurrent. I was supposed to report to Alcoholics Anonymous the day I was sentenced, right there and then. As soon as I left jail, I was supposed to start going. I didn't. I began to attend the drug and alcohol meetings. And the guy who was teaching there, the probation officer, used to come in every once in a while to pick up the cards. And he told me, "Ralph, you haven't been going to AA." I said, oh yeah, I'll go at the end of my sentence. I'll go. And she says, no. Did you read your court order? I said, well, I was there in court when the judge spoke. He said, Rabbi, I didn't ask you if you were in court. Of course you were in court. You're the suspect. He says, did you read the court order? I said, no. So he said, here is a copy of it. And he pulled it in and from my file. And he was reading the court order. He says, it says you're supposed to be attending AA meetings and turning in those court cards to your probation officer on a weekly basis. And you haven't done so. And it's been about a month and a half. You're in violation of your probation. And you know what happens when you violate probation. You go back to prison. So that felt really bad. You know. So he gave me an AA directory. And he says, he had my file. He said, he knows where I live. He says, this meeting here is on your way home. You can just stop there. So I drove all the way that night, actually, and I stopped at this AA meeting. And I walked in, and I just couldn't identify at all. There were folks there with torn clothes, with tattoos all over their heads and necks and arms and chains hanging from their side. And these were the ladies, you know. The guys were much, much meaner than that. And I said, oh my God, you know, what am I doing here? See, I was judging a book by its cover. I did not listen to these folks, nor get to know them, or know what they have been through, or what they do for a living, or what they don't do for a living. I just judged the cover, judged the outside appearances, you know. Those folks had become, after a year of going there, some of my best friends, some of the kindest, the most loving people, most of them, that I have ever met in my life. Honorable. I remember one time my wife was in Japan already with the kids, and I was heading to the old country, and I was going to leave my house, you know, and whom do I give my keys to, you know, to come and check on the house every once in a while? It was one of those folks who had done 18 years in San Quentin. I gave him the keys to my house and I told him, please come and check on the house when you can. He was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, as honorable as they come. And it's just unbelievable the kind of folks that you end up meeting in AA. But in any event, I walked into AA and I did not identify. I saw the people doing the Lord's Prayer and holding hands. God, 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 people sitting up to share, God, God, God. And, you know, I'm an atheist. I said, this stuff, you know, it is like trying to proselytize me into this cult. You know, and I'm not going to be any part of this. But I had to go on a weekly basis. So I kept going. And I took a commitment because out of the kindness of my heart, and though I didn't have a driver's license, I did have a car. I bought the same car that I wrecked, actually, an Lexus RX something. And I used to pick up this lady called Jean. She passed away many years ago from an assisted living place. She was sober a long time, and she was a devout Catholic. And she was always trying to give me one of those books that she reads that is published by some of the publications of the Catholic Church in Los Angeles. And Jean was a very nice, very kind woman. When she was young, she was a rebel. She was a dancer in New York. She danced in theater, you know. And she was a wobbly, is what they call them. These are the radical left-wing members of the International Workers of the World, the IWW. And she was involved in all kinds of political activities, left-wing to the zilch, except, you know, she got old and she was ill. She had serious health problems. And she was very devoutly Catholic nonetheless and sober for a long time. But she knew some of the writings and some of the literature and so on. And she told me one time, because she noticed that I was a nervous wreck. And those weeks after August 3rd of 99, from August 4th of 99 until about mid-December of 99, I was going to AA. I was not drinking, but I had absolutely no program whatsoever. I was nervous wreck, and it was the worst 4 months of my life, slamming phones at work, slamming drawers, slamming doors at home also, yelling at the kids, noticing that my wife is putting too much damn soy sauce in my food, and that my daughter had pierced her belly button, and my son painted his friggin' hair pink and blue and green and turning into a peacock. And essentially what I had really become is at least in the family afterwards of the big book, I become an active participant in my family life. And it was killing me that things were not going my way. And that stuff that's been going on all the time, except I was oblivious to it because I was either drunk or period, not there at all. So I began to get involved and it didn't like what I saw. But this Jean lady one time, she told me, Ralph, she said, why don't you just try to drive your own car instead of driving everybody else's car, for God's sake? Because I was angry at people. I was not cursing or anything, but I was angry and making remarks about how this idiot changed lanes without putting his signal, how that idiot, you know, is driving too slow and so on. And she, I told her, Jean, this AA thing is not working for me. And I've been coming now for a few months, and it's just absolutely doing me no good. And she said, Ralph, if you don't mind me saying so, I haven't seen you raise your hand identifying as a newcomer or even as an alcoholic. You're coming because you have a court card that needs to be signed. That's all. And she said, I'll tell you what your problem is. And I said, what is it? She said, you have a twin brother living inside you. His name is also Ralph. But he knows he's an alcoholic, while you don't. And you are depriving Ralph of his medicine, his alcohol, his drink. You're depriving him. And one of two things are going to happen to you, Ralph. She said, you're either going to kill yourself, or Ralph will kill you. Or more likely, he'll pick up and drink, which is what alcoholics do when they are trapped, when they have no tools, no coping mechanism, he will drink. And so I said, so what's the solution? She said, the solution is the steps, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. She says, you can take them because the elevator is broken. Take the steps and you will learn something about who Ralph is. You'll discover who you are and you'll be able to live with that guy without needing to drink. So I said, what steps are you talking about? Now, I've been going there for a few months. The steps are read in every meeting when they read how it works. Chapter 5, how it works, to read the 12 steps. In addition, the steps were all over that hall that I used to take, the Alano Club that I used to take it to. They were all over the place. They were both in English and in Spanish. And they were in calligraphy, beautifully written. And I never saw them. I probably saw them, but they didn't register. It didn't make sense. There was God here and God there. And I probably noticed them and ignored them completely. And they were read anyway, and I haven't heard them. I haven't heard them because I was going to the meetings, but I was not a participant in the meeting. My body was there, but my mind was settling issues with the Internal Revenue Service, the Franchise Tax Board, with a personnel problems at the office, with a client who left the company, with a lawsuit, a claim that has been filed against us. I was doing all kinds of things and balancing checkbooks while I was sitting in an AA meeting. I was not lending a loving ear to listen to people who were talking, who were speaking from their heart, who were spewing their guts, talking about what's happening in their life with their autistic child, or with the son who will not talk to them, or with the husband who left her and took the kids, or with the courts. I just was not paying attention to any of that stuff. I was literally just there in body, but not in mind. And these things hit me, actually. I waited for a couple of days, making sure that Jean wasn't there to see me raise my hand and say, I'm an alcoholic, my name is Ralph, and I'm new to the program. And I didn't want her to see me because then she may think that she has won the argument. And I would rather be caught dead than be caught wrong. I raised my hand and I said, my name is Ralph, I'm an alcoholic. And that really was a pivotal turn in my life. You know, I didn't drink, so I was sober since August 4th of 99, but it took until mid-December, toward the end of December, before I actually really joined Alcoholics Anonymous. Really, not so much joining Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't have a card that says I'm a member, but I have began participating in my life and on my path to sobriety. And what happened is a few weeks later, I remember there was somebody was sharing and I began actually to experience something I had not experienced for probably more than 30 years. and that is tears. I thought that my tear ducts had been plugged, or that my tear glands, my lacrimal glands, were desiccated. When in reality, I began to tear up when people were sharing, because I began to listen to people talk about their lives and about what's happening to them and to their children and to their parents and to their neighbors and to their cousins and so on. And I began to choke up and actually tear up. And I remember one time, I just controllably sobbing, and the tears were was really hurting because of the share of this young lady. And I walked toward the coffee bar to hide myself. And my friend Bob was behind the coffee bar. And I told him, he's the guy who gave me the commitment to pick up Jean from her assisted living place twice a week. I told him, Bob, I don't know what the hell is happening to me, but I'm crying. And I told him, I haven't cried when my mother died, and I haven't cried when my father died. I went down the grave with him, and I didn't cry. I was drunk, of course. I didn't cry. And I said, now I'm crying, and I'm listening to this stranger talking about her problems with her dad and her mom and stuff. And Bob came around the coffee counter, and he went like this. He says, Ralph, welcome to the human race. Welcome back to humanity. He said, tearing up, feeling what other people are feeling is one of the first signs of sobriety. And he said, and of recovery. He says, you're just coming back to your roots, to your humanity, to being a human being. And that is a very, very good sign. He says, when we get sober, the bad news is we get our feelings back. And the good news is we get our feelings back. So you're becoming a sentient being again from the stone that alcohol has turned you into. And he was absolutely right. You know, I remembered when he said that, you know, thinking about the story that our grandfather used to tell us, or a tale. And this is old Arabic saying, you know, when the folks who were taking care of the sick man, notice that the sick man is asking questions about other people and about how other people are feeling. Those who are caring for the sick man start rejoicing with happiness because they realize that recovery has set in. Recovery has commenced because I'm no longer thinking about myself. I'm thinking about somebody else. That is truly the first sign of recovery, is breaking out of that bondage of self and beginning to feel for other people and to realize what other people are feeling, and to start, the word, I guess, is sympathizing or empathizing with them. And Bob helped me tremendously. So did Jean. There are hundreds of people who helped me tremendously in the program, all because of their kindness. Because of their patience, but also because of the advice that they gave. And very seldom was it unsolicited advice, although I would have taken that too. And most of the time it was me asking questions. And the analogies were really flagrant. You know, one guy one time told me that the program is really simple. He says, think of nutrition. Think of the food you eat. You could eat some beets, some nuts, some vegetables, some fruits. If you eat them fast, they'll go into your stomach, but in all likelihood, you'll regurgitate them, you'll spill them out. You will have an indigestion and you throw them out. He says, in order to assimilate something, in order for your body to actually be nourished by what you eat, you have to chew it. You have to chew it slowly, preferably, and give it a chance to settle in your stomach so it is absorbed by your body and goes into your bloodstream and have some kind of value to it. He said, you're going to come across a bunch of folks in AA who have read the steps, read the big book, who will be throwing out, spewing phrases and cliches. It doesn't mean they believe it. It doesn't mean it has entered their lives. He says, if you really want it to become a part of you, you got to make the principles an integral part of your DNA. The principles that are on black and white on paper have to become your principles, not something I borrow every once in a while and I use every once in a while. It has become part of my code of ethics, part of my own beliefs. And I have literally been practicing that for the last 21 years. I have attended, participated in, big book studies, step studies, tradition studies. I have taken commitments. I mean, truly mind-altering experiences that I have witnessed with just by going to prison, you know, jumping in a car with some friends here in Southern California and going to Central California or Northern LA County or Kern County to Tehachapi Prison and actually meeting with some folks in any of those wards. You know, we end up having the meeting on the way to that meeting, you know, three or four of us in one car chatting and sometimes stopping for breakfast if we meet early, always meeting for lunch or dinner after the prison panel or the jail panel. And we go into prison, we see folks who have had a real tough time. And it was really amazing is, you know, I used to go to a Bible study out of courtesy. I'm an atheist, but I went to a Bible study because of my name. A guy assumed I was a Muslim. And he was Jewish, and actually the guy was a doctor and a rabbinical scholar. And there were some couple of Christians here and there. We used to go to Bible studies in the heart of Beverly Hills and Bel Air in these incredible, incredible multi-million dollar mansions, you know. And you know, beside the friendship and the love and the care and stuff, you also see the misery and the sadness and the human tragedy in the midst of opulence. And every once in a while, in those prison jails that I go, panels that I went to, I would run into somebody who was a lifer. That is somebody who was sentenced to death, but whose sentence was commuted to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And this guy would have been there for 30 or 40 years. And you would see the incredible serenity and peace of mind and the true joy of living that that person would have in prison with no likelihood of ever leaving, although we've petitioned on, for some of the cases, guys who were members and sober for a long time. And we've tried to get the governor to give them parole, to give them a chance to get the heck out of there and do some good for the rest of society. But on the other hand, they're probably doing a lot of good right there in prison. It's not unheard of for some people who actually do their duty wherever they are. And that's just another venue. You know, I listened to a fellow recently, a Filipino-American guy from San Francisco. He's a medical doctor. He was talking about his brother who took the wrong turn at a fairly early age in his mid-20s and ended up in prison for 40 years. And, you know, he's been fighting for his brother to try to get out. The brother was actually trying to fight to get out and had a miserable time. He went to law school while in prison, did lots of studies and stuff, and he was not able to commute his sentence or get parole. But the last time he saw him, the guy was sent out of prison to a county hospital, and he was with COVID-19. He was dying. You know, they called him down here and told him that your brother is dying. You may want to come by and wave at him from outside or something, or do Zoom or FaceTime or whatever. So he said he talked to from afar. His brother couldn't talk. He was incubated, you know. But that was the last time he saw his brother. His brother died about a week later. And this is about 6 months ago. He said he was bombarded with the messages and letters of condolences from prison. And these guys are telling him that they call him Mr. E. His name is Eric. They say that man has done incredible. He said he has never seen a person so much loved, so much cared for by inmates and ex-inmates and people who just love this man. He said he probably helped more people in prison than I have helped patients out here as a medical doctor. He said, and I thought he was miserable, that he had a miserable life. That is, you never know him. But I'll tell you, in AA, my life changed. I had my life with my wife and with my kids, with my neighbors, with my brothers and sisters. It changed 180 degrees from what it was. I have rekindled my friendships with friends that I have ignored because as a drunk, my life had shrunk to an almost nothing. I had become a tiny shell of myself and a miserable one at that. But I came to learn all kinds of things. They talk, you know, AA is not necessarily a religious program. I know some people take it that way. But as an atheist, I had to come to terms with the fact that this thing is working to let me see how I can have it work for me for those around me. And I saw that the stuff that they call like a paradox, a paradox, and say you have to give it in order to keep it. And I love that because I came to realize that that really is a reflection of the symbiotic nature of life. It's not about giving or taking. It's about being within. And I remembered one time I was reading, because I went back to reading stuff I had scoffed at for many years, because as an atheist, an alcoholic, I had become a cynic also. I had also become a sarcastic person who mistook sarcasm for humor, and I mistook cynicism for skepticism. And these are totally different things, of course. I became aware of that in the program as a sober man, as a result of my involvement with other people rubbing shoulders and stuff. I went back to reading Gibran, Khalil Gibran, the Prophet, among others. I've read the other books also, but in the Prophet, Mitra is asking al-Mustafa, the Prophet, tell us about giving and taking, taking and giving. And he says, and I'm paraphrasing, he says that the rich man who gives a little of the much he has in expectation of fame, like a name on a building, and the poor man who gives a lot of the little he has in the hope of a seat in heaven, says those are merchants who just concluded transactions with their higher power. Says the true givers are those who give in expectation of nothing in return. They give of their time, they give of their sweat, they give of their labor, they give of their feelings and their heart and their friendship in expectation of nothing in return. He says they give in order to live. And he goes on, of course, as a poet, and he says, look at the valley yonder and look at the flowers as they open up and give of their beauty and of their aroma and of their scent. And look at the bee as it approaches the flower and as it begins to suckle the nectar from the bottom of the callus of that rose. He says, the bee is pollinating and giving life to the flower, and the flower is giving its nectar. And Zen would say that there really is no giver and no taker, and there is no gift. It's all one. But in a linear word, and for us rational human beings, we like to see things in terms of cause and effect. And I like to see the fact that the bee is giving life, and the flower is giving nectar, and there is a gift, which is the pollination and fertilization and the nectar also. But in reality, it's all one. And I think in AA, I've discovered that the real force of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think is what Frank read early on, in the beginning of the AA tradition. In tradition one, it talks quite a bit about that. It talks about the fact that we are all interdependent. We are all one, that a butterfly flap its wings in China could cause a tidal wave in the Philippines. It's all, everything is part of the same body of existence and of being. The atoms are the same, they haven't changed. The molecules are the same, they haven't changed. And I didn't bring anything new into this world. Everything in me has been around for no less than 4 billion years. And it's just all transformation of everything. In AA, I see the holding hands. I see the leaning on each other. I see the calling each other for advice and staying in touch with each other, realizing that we need each other. And we are, I think, wired by nature, by millions of years of evolution, to be interdependent and interconnected. You know, that symbiosis is truly the rule that governs life as we know it on this planet. There's a new book that just came out a couple of weeks ago called In Search of the Mother Tree. And it's really talking about the interconnection. Because when we look at trees or look at a forest, we only see the leaves and the trunks. We don't see what's underground, how the roots of the plants connect with each other, how the roots of different species of plants connect with each other. Not so much fighting for water, but feeding each other and giving each other a chance to live and to survive. I found that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you, I came into the program with the attitude from Invictus that says, in the fell clutch of circumstance, I haven't winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head was bloodied but unbowed. I felt that way coming in. And he goes on actually with a very affirmative statement The poet says, it matters not how straight the gate, how charged the punishments, the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. That is a statement of the responsibility. We have it in the program as that I am responsible, and we are all responsible and dependent on each other for help. That nobody gets paid in AA. We have to collect money to print leaflets. We have sometimes to collect money to help someone attend a retreat. I go to retreats twice a year. I see the same alcoholic brothers and sisters on a daily basis, have done so for the last 21 years. I love the way life has become, which is really, I love the way that I began to look at life. And it is truly important that we continue. I think the literature, the 12 and 12 and the big book and all the other conference approved literature, I think they are no more than a springboard for Alcoholics Anonymous, for this alcoholic. That just opens the door. That's the beginning. But I think the program can be sought and one can deepen one's understanding of Alcoholics Anonymous, and one can deepen one's understanding of life in general as a sober man and a sober participant in society. I'm forever grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to wrap it up with a quote from Chuck C. In the New Pair of Glasses. He quotes an American poet of the late 19th century. Her name is Ellen Wilcox Wheeler, or maybe Ellen Wheeler Wilcox. She wrote a poem because she was sitting at the harbor in Connecticut maybe in Boston, actually, seeing some sail ships coming into the harbor and the same sail ships leaving the harbor. And she wondered how could they be going in opposite directions while the wind is blowing in one direction. And so she said, one ship sails east, the other sails west, in the self-same winds that blow. It is the set of the sails, not the wind nor the gales, that points the way to go. And like the ways of the seas are the ways of fate, as we journey along through life, is the set of the soul that decides its goal, not the calm nor the strife. And I think that's what AA does. You know, in the big book, it says that we learn how to match calamity with serenity. What it really means is that we learn, as the Stoics would put it, we learn some self-control. You know, in the big book it says restraint of pen and tongue. But that's I remain as I get older. I'm in my 70s now. As I get older, and the interval of consciousness narrows, the remaining interval of consciousness narrows. I continue to be devoutly atheist and scientifically oriented and inclined, but that does not negate the fact that in secular humanism, there is a great deal of what one would call spirituality, love of one another, care for one another, assistance to one another. AA has given me a chance to experience those on a daily basis, and for that, I shall forever be grateful. I have one daughter who's now a grown-up 35-year-old woman. She's going to be sworn in as an attorney in a month or two. And I have her brother, older brother, my son, is in state prison in Nevada. Unfortunately, he's one of us, and he hasn't seen the light yet. I come to AA because I know that there is hope. I have seen folks come into AA. I came in when I was 50 years old, 21 years ago. And I know there is hope for my son if he eventually breaks the egoic mind that is like in the story of the jaywalker, keeps falling and getting back, getting his kicks out of getting run over by cars. Eventually, his will will break and he will become willing to live life sober and to enjoy life. I wish each and every one of you a great day and a happy Mother's Day in this country. It is Mother's Day in the States. And I wish you a sober life and an enjoyable one regardless. Thank you very much for indulging me. Thank you very much for listening to me. Thank you, Mark, and thank you, Frank, for being here. Take good care.